Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
Was there a long line? Jenny asked after I threaded my way through the shoulder-to-shoulder crowd back to the table. Wendy was sitting at the end of our table, but was chatting up a cute guy at the next table. She showed him a little more of her bear tattoo than we'd seen, generating a lecherous comment, and something whispered in Wendy's ear. Wendy took a furtive glance at his left hand and noticed a tan line on his ring finger. "Nice try, married boy," Wendy said before pulling her chair back to the end of our table. "Isn't that the way it goes? The nice ones are either married or gay," she said, sighing. "I thought you liked the bass player," Jenny said. Wendy shook her head, looking across the room to where the bassist was chatting up a 50-something woman who was trying to look like she was 30-something. "He's into cougars." "Cougars?" I asked. Wendy rolled her eyes. "You ought to get out more, Peter. Cougars are middle-aged women looking for younger men. Larry says he likes them because they're not hung up about casual sex, not worried about getting pregnant, and they tend to pay for everything. Being a boy toy works pretty well for him. I can't support him in the manner to which he's become accustomed." "Joey, the guitar player, is more into women his own age," she said, pointing him out at the bar where he was hanging on a pretty young thing who was wearing a tank top that showed a large portion of a scaly dragon tattoo with its tail wrapped around her neck. "He's into the girl with the dragon tattoo tonight." "I wonder if she wears a turtleneck to job interviews," Jenny asked rhetorically. "I think she's a massage therapist," I said, garnering inquisitive looks from both women. "I heard some guy at the bar say she rubbed him the wrong way." Wendy moaned, and Jenny punched my arm and said, "That's so lame." The violinist and guitar player were back on stage. They started their own version of dueling banjos. Wendy jumped up from her chair as the rest of the band pressed their way through the crowd. "They're actually very good," Jenny yelled to me over all the noise. "They all were professionals in other places and decided to move back to the region after they didn't hit it big," I said. Wendy told me that the violinist was first chair for the Knoxville, Tennessee Symphony, but missed the Winters and her family. The bass player was with a couple of touring shows, and the guitar player toured with Steve Martin when he was doing his bluegrass thing. Jenny leaned across the table and held my hand. "Your voice is as good as the guy playing guitar. If you practiced a little, you could master the riffs he's playing, and you could move beyond Friday nights at Hugo's Bar and entertaining little old ladies." I kissed her. If I did, I could run off to Nashville or New York and play backup occasionally while I waited tables. Then a few years later, I would get fed up, come back here, and marry you. Jenny's head jerked up. "Did you just propose to me?" My jaw locked. I could see she was a little tipsy, but not so drunk she wouldn't remember this conversation in the morning. It was kind of a hypothetical. "If all those things happened, would you still have me?" was what I was saying or asking. As the words tumbled out, they sounded lame even to me. "So you didn't propose?" "When I propose, I will get on one knee and ask you in a very romantic way. It won't be in a noisy bar with cougars and dragon ladies when we've both been drinking." "So you're going to ask me to marry you?" she said in an outdoor voice. "Can we have this conversation later?" I said into her ear. "Maybe I won't say yes if you ask me later. I'd say yes if you ask me now." It occurred to me as she slurred her words that I was getting her unfiltered feelings. There were only two possible ways to end the conversation. Plan A would get a yes answer and would be permanent. Plan B would be immediately messy and might mean that there might not ever be a chance to have a plan A at some later time. There had to be a plan C. As it turned out, Wendy came to the rescue. A round of applause rolled through the club as the last notes of Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain echoed through the rafters. Wendy stepped up to the microphone and said, "One of my close friends is a very talented musician, and he's in the audience tonight. If you encourage him with a round of applause, he might come up here and sing the Willie Nelson part of Pancho and Lefty." I was swept to the stage before I could say anything else to Jenny. After getting a loner guitar and stumbling through a few bars, I became one with the band, and it was magical. Larry, the bass player, had a beautiful, resonant baritone voice with just enough rasp to sound like Waylon Jennings. I pulled off a pretty good Willie Nelson, and when the song ended, the club erupted. The band kept me on stage for two more numbers. Then Wendy told me they were going to wrap up with a Jackson Brown rendition of Stay. "You're doing the falsetto verse," she whispered. "I can't," I protested. "I've never done falsetto in front of an audience." "You do it all in time in front of the residents." "But half of them are deaf, and the other half would be happy to listen to a one-armed accordionist." "Try." When I hit the falsetto, "Oh, won't you stay just a little bit longer," the crowd cheered and whistled, and I floated through it on adrenaline. My voice held up, and the band picked up the rest of the vocals. When the applause stopped, people swarmed the stage, and all the musicians were getting kudos. I was slapped on the back, knuckle-bumped, and kissed as I pressed my way through the crowd. A middle-aged woman with platinum blonde hair who smelled like cigarettes pressed herself against me and gave me a kiss that involved her tongue trying to find my tonsils. I pushed myself away, leaving her with a sad pout that made me believe I could have spent the night with my first cougar groupie. I felt a sudden urgency to find Jenny, hoping I hadn't contracted any communicable disease from cougar slobber. I finally saw Jenny near the door talking to a man with hints of gray at his temples. Behind them was a tin sign advertising Katie's Ice Fishing School. It said that Katie would teach you how to keep your tip up. Tony, the owner, who sported a black goatee and his own camo cap, gave me a nod and asked, "Will that Friday work for you, Pete?" "I'll check," I yelled over the crowd noise. He nodded and gave me a wave, then went back to filling the orders for the people still lined too deep at the bar. Jenny's expression was too serious for the venue, and I wondered what was going on. When I got close, she waved me over. "Peter, this is Axel's son Gary," Jenny said, trying to be heard over the crowd. "I should have talked to you guys about the funeral a few days ago," he said apologetically. We leaned close to hear his soft voice. I was hoping that we could add a military honor guard to the graveside service. The adrenaline was still flowing, and it took me a few seconds to get back to my other world. "It's already Wednesday night, and the funeral is Friday. I don't have much chance to set that up. If I'd had a couple more days, I might have been able to contact the American Legion or the VFW, but I'm pretty sure they couldn't get someone with this short notice." "I'm sorry. My sister was supposed to tell you about Dad's wishes for a military funeral, but I think she was more interested in spending his money to spite him. He was quite emphatic that he wanted to be cremated and buried with military honors. I didn't find out until this afternoon that she'd given you other directions." He spoke softly, and I struggled to hear, almost putting my ear next to his lips. "How did you find us here?" I asked. "I called Whistling Pines, and they told me that someone named Wendy is an entertainer, and almost everyone knew that you were going to see her perform tonight." He paused and shook his head. "I made some calls Monday, after Dad died. I thought I might be able to get someone from the military to step up, but I haven't heard back from them." "I just don't think I can pull it off," I said, looking at my watch. Gary looked at his shoes and shook his head. "Were you at least able to find bagpipes?" "We might have someone coming," I said, although Jenny was shaking her head. "But I'm not optimistic." Gary was near tears. "I should have been on this yesterday. It's not your fault." He took a deep breath and shook his head. I guess I'll call the consulate again and hope for the best. He shook our hands and turned away. I was pretty sure I'd just met Axel's one child who didn't make the list of probable killers. As we walked to the car, Jenny asked me, "Did he say he was calling the counselor or consulate?" I couldn't hear half of what he said. My ears are still ringing from the loud music. I opened Jenny's car door, and she turned to face me, planting a big kiss on my lips. "I know you had plans for tonight, but all this talk about the funeral has really squashed my libido. Do you think we could go back to your place and just snuggle? I just need you to hold me close tonight." In this one case, the answer was clear. Snuggling would be great. Whistling Pines, Chapter 22. We held hands on the drive back to Two Harbors, then Jenny leaned back with her eyes closed. "I've never heard you perform most of the songs you played with the band tonight," Jenny said, "but you played like you'd practiced them a lot. How can you do that?" "I play by ear," I replied. "I've heard the songs, so I recognize the background guitar chord progression. It's not that hard." "You played a guitar riff the same as Jackson Browne plays on piano. That's not chords on a background guitar, and I'm sure it's not easy." I struggled to find an answer. There was a lot of downtime in Iraq, so I spent a lot of hours picking at my guitar. The Marines asked me to play a lot of their favorite songs, so I learned to stumble my way through any song they requested. "You could be professional," Jenny said, taking my hand and squeezing it. "I'm just lucky you've chosen to be here with me." Within 2 miles, her hand relaxed, and she was making soft, sleepy sounds. I still had enough adrenaline from the performance to fuel a 747. Visions of the bright lights of Nashville and Memphis, with huge venues full of cheering fans, flowed through my head. Pretty women with skimpy costumes were throwing underwear and hotel keys on the stage. Then I flashed ahead to the generic motels with little bottles of shampoo and crappy fast food and thousands of miles in crowded tour buses. The highs from the concerts would give way to lows of the hours hanging around hotels and arenas, waiting and waiting. My life now was quiet and regular. There weren't many highs, but the lows weren't very low. People showed appreciation for what I did every day. The residents loved me and my music. Better than that, there was Jenny, who wanted to marry me and be with me the rest of my life. I had a sudden flashback to Hugo's and the drunk woman who slipped me her tongue, and I knew that I didn't want a life on the road, especially if it involved drunk middle-aged groupies who smelled of cigarettes and stuck their tongues in my mouth. The rumble of the tires on the gravel gave way to the whine of asphalt. As we neared Two Harbors, a billboard advertising 2,000-square-foot lakeside timeshares with mini-bars and whirlpool tubs loomed next to the road. Ironically, we were passing old tourist cabins that had been built in the 1930s when tourists were able to drive two-lane Highway 61 from the Twin Cities to Two Harbors in 4 hours, happy to rent a cabin with a bed and a nearby outhouse. People's expectations of their vacation rentals had changed during the past century. My life was somewhere in between, with an expectation of indoor plumbing, but not a hot tub. Iraq helped me realize what was important, and I was happy to exchange a high-stress life for Whistling Pines and Jenny. The adrenaline had worn off by the time we reached my neighborhood. Jenny had been asleep for most of an hour. Her eyes opened as I turned onto the side streets. She looked out the side windows and watched the houses pass as I wound down the street to my house. "Peter, are you prepared for the funeral?" she asked sleepily. "I think so. I mean, there will be a funeral. We have a church and minister. Wendy has the music under control. At least she told me that she has plans, and she's never let me down. The bus is coming to deliver the residents to the church, and I spoke with the head of the Ladies' Aid Society, and they will have lunch for 200 people, so I think everything is prepared. What about the bagpipes? I don't know. Are you going to call the VFW and American Legion? There isn't any point. It's too late for them to pull together an honor guard. Will it go smoothly? I have no idea. If it doesn't, the funeral will be memorable. We walked hand in hand to the house in silence. Jenny stripped off her coat and hung it on a peg by the door. She looked troubled. I feel bad, she said. There will be 100 or more people at the funeral, and I don't think that one of them will be there for anything but the spectacle. I mean, no one will be there because Axel was their friend or because they respected him. They're all coming to see bagpipes or for the lunch. Funerals aren't for the dead, they're for the living. Hardly anyone comes for the deceased. I've talked to our residents on the way back from funerals, and do you know what they talk about? They talk about what was served for lunch, or how good or bad the dead person looked, or how many of their old friends they saw. It's a social event, like an extended family reunion. People come from all over to see each other. All that will happen Friday. When we climbed into bed, Jenny in an oversized purple Vikings jersey and me in my boxers, Jenny seemed subdued. She turned her back to me and pulled my arms across her waist and wiggled until we were nested like spoons. I want people to come to my funeral because they like me, she said after a moment of silence. I'm sure people will come to your funeral because they like and respect you, I said, pulling her tighter and kissing her neck. She rolled over so we were face to face, and she slid her finger down my jaw. You were really good with the band tonight. I was scared when Wendy asked me to sing falsetto. I wish I'd had a video camera. The expression on your face was priceless. She pressed her face to mine and kissed me gently. I can't sleep. Oh? I shaved my legs this morning. That's nice, I said, not quite knowing where the discussion was going. They're nice and smooth. Peter, can you take a hint? I think so. Why? That was a hint. The shaved legs, you mean? Uh-huh, she replied, pressing her hips against my pelvis. It feels like you're catching on. I think I've got the idea now. Whistling Pines, Chapter 23, Thursday. I didn't sleep well with the combination of adrenaline, loud music, rich food, passion, and a few too many adult beverages. At 3 a.m. I gave up on the prospect of sleep, slipped into the shower and let the water pound on my neck and back until the hot water turned icy. I did a quick shampoo in cold water and came out of the shower chilled and wide awake. I quietly found a golf shirt and khaki pants in the closet and socks and underwear folded in a laundry basket on top of the washer. I slipped them on downstairs. I didn't want to wake Jenny, so I decided to forego breakfast rather than rattle around the kitchen making coffee and trying to find something edible. In the kitchen, I found the display box with the medals sitting on the table. I gently lifted the lid, looked at the ribbons, and immediately felt sad. I made a spot in the cupboard next to the cereal and slipped the box out of sight. I left Jenny a note and considered locking the door for her safety, but I couldn't remember where the key might be. I hadn't locked it since I moved in. There never seemed to be a need before. I thought about hiring a locksmith, then decided I was being needlessly paranoid. The Thursday morning paper was on the doorstep when I walked out. I quickly scanned the headlines and found that Axel's murder had slipped from the page one headline to page four. The article identified Axel as the previously unnamed murder victim and said the medical examiner determined the cause of death to be a stab wound. The reporter quoted a BCA investigator who thought a suspect would be in custody within a few days. "I wonder if the medical examiner found a heart when he looked inside Axel's chest," I muttered. The whole milieu of the previous evening had my mind swimming. Wendy's craziness, the band's pounding rhythms, Jenny's unveiled hint that she wanted a marriage proposal, and unanswered questions about Axel's death and whoever hated him enough to kill him. And, of course, the funeral plans. There were so many motives for someone to kill Axel, and dozens of people who hated him. My mind boggled with the combinations of motive and opportunity. As I drove through the dark streets of Seagog, I tried to sort the tidbits I'd gathered into some sort of organized pattern. The whole thing was becoming a kaleidoscope with changing patterns and colors as I twisted the information in my mind. I was overwhelmed by the irregular spurts of information that came to me from so many disconnected sources. When I'd taken a criminology course, they'd said to organize a timeline of events and then use that to eliminate and prioritize suspects. What they hadn't told me was that there could be a dozen or more suspects with motives that were spread over decades, and that the information would pop up unexpectedly when I wasn't prepared to receive it or deal with it. I was tempted to give up my role as undercover investigator, throw the whole thing back to Len Rents, and go back to being a pretty good activities director. The pre-dawn calm lent an air of eeriness to the Whistling Pines parking lot. I shivered as I walked across the open expanse of the employee parking lot behind the building. I could hear the gurgling wash of gentle Lake Superior swells as they struck riprap along the shoreline and receded. Any other morning I might have been tempted to walk to the edge of the lawn and look at the lake in the moonlight, but Axel's murder left me unsettled. I could smell coffee as I slipped in the delivery door. I quickly shed my coat in my office before returning to the kitchen for a caffeine fix. There were already a half dozen women in the kitchen. Two huge stainless steel stock pots were already bubbling with soup, and three women chatted as they chopped vegetables and slid them into broth. Two older women were pulling dough from the paddles of a Hobart mixer, and a third was preparing pans for caramel rolls that would soon be baking. They were all in their own worlds as they chatted over their chores, and no one seemed to notice as I tapped a cup of coffee from the urn and wandered into the dining room. A lone figure was carefully spreading white tablecloths on the tables, then setting each with water glasses and stainless flatware. I watched silently as Flory smoothed the wrinkles from the tablecloths and arranged them carefully before putting out the place settings. As she shook out a folded tablecloth, Flory saw me watching her and smiled. "Peter, are you staring at my behind again?" she asked. I could feel the red creeping up my face. "I was just thinking about how efficient you were and what great pride you take in your work," I replied. Flory was working at Whistling Pines when I started 2 years ago, and considering that her skin was the color of dark mocha in a land of blue-eyed blondes, she had a way of becoming part of the wallpaper when she chose to be invisible. She worked the same 5 a.m. shift as the early kitchen staff, where she prepped the dining room while the cooks started dough and soups, and went home shortly after the lunch tables were cleared and reset for dinner. She finished arranging the tablecloth and swayed across the room. She picked up a coffee cup, filled it, then sat down in a chair at the nearest table. She patted the chair next to her, and I sat down, even though the narrow distance between our chairs violated my Minnesota sense of personal space. "I hear that you're the police spy who's investigating that old bastard's death." Close up, I could see her face looked tired, and her eyes were bloodshot. I shifted in the chair mostly because I wasn't comfortable being characterized as a spy. "I've been asking around a little." Then I paused, and the rest of her words struck me. "Why did you call him an old bastard?" Flory smiled and leaned closer to me in a way that made her more than ample girth strain against the buttons of her dress. Without thinking, my eyes wandered to the Grand Canyon of cleavage as she said, "I call him a bastard because that is the technical description of someone who was born out of wedlock." "What?" Startled, my eyes met hers again. "Peter, honey, old Axel was a bastard in the literal sense of the word, as were at least two of his children." Flory had a smile that disarmed me to the point where I felt like I was talking with my own minister, or maybe my grandmother. I felt like I'd known of her for most of my life, and when I first met her, I thought she was old. As time passed, she seemed to get younger, and now I was guessing that she wasn't much more than 50 years old, but her eyes looked like they've seen a century of experience. Flory scooped up our coffee cups and headed for the kitchen, leaving me stunned by her words. When she came back, her gait made her body glide with the rhythm of her steps. She noticed the way I was watching her, and as she set the steaming coffee cups on the table, she leaned close and wiped something from my cheek in a way that was both maternal and sensuous at the same time. "Peter, I see that you have come to appreciate the beauty of a full-figured woman." She did a pirouette and then sat in the chair, again violating my personal space. "I don't know what you see in that little strawberry blonde girl that you chase around. She hasn't seen enough of the world to know what's real and what's not, and she's so skinny that you're probably cut yourself on those sharp little bony hips of hers."
You've been listening to episode 11 of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org, under the Programs tab near the top of the home page. Just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.
Hard as kerosene. You weren't your mama's only boy, but her favorite one it seemed. So she began to cry when you said goodbye and sank into your dreams. Poncho was a bandit, boys. His horse was fast as polished steel. He wore his gun outside his pants.